You're listening to Lost Voices, a podcast about demystifying archives and the South Asian experience in Canada. I'm Alicia. I'm a journalist and editor from Toronto. If you joined us in the last episode, you'll remember I talked about value and who decides what research is valuable at all. So if you've been following along, we now have a better understanding of how the Gwillim Archive came to be, from Dr. Casey Wood and his spontaneous discovery of Elizabeth Gwillim's bird drawings from India. Today, we're talking about oral history. And before I bring in our guests, I'd like to have a moment to tell you about how South Asian millennials, myself included, are turning the idea of oral history on its head. The Gwillim letters were largely forgotten, and without them, we wouldn't have such a deep understanding of the India that the Gwillim sisters lived in. By looking at these letters in a new light, we are redefining and evolving what oral history means. Fortunately, a lot of my own history has been passed down because of oral traditions from my ancestors. I've mentioned a few Instagram accounts and podcasts that are rethinking the entire definition of archives. One of those is the Brown History Podcast. It's a crowdsourced collective that started in March 2019. Its founder, Asan Zafar, who's from Toronto, wanted to humanize history. Half-remembered anecdotes, fading family albums, treasured tales, and more than 1,000 submissions, and almost 2 years later, the platform now has a community of more than 500,000 people, all tasked with telling and retelling lesser-known stories and lives. Here is just one example from the account that I really love.
So this is my Didu and Nana Bai. They met during a period where there was a lot of religious tension between Hindus and Muslims in Bangladesh. During a specific riot, one of my grandmother's brothers got arrested, so she had to see my grandfather to pay his bail because at this time, my grandfather was the subdivision officer of Meherpur Kushtia in the district of Khulna in Bangladesh. Basically, he was working in the equivalent of the mayor's office. My grandmother went with her dad to get her brother released. My grandfather thought she was very attractive and asked her out before she left. Initially, she thought it was wrong because he was Muslim. My grandmother is Hindu. But after she saw him again, she accepted. They fell in love and saw each other in secret until she agreed to marry him. He asked her father for her hand, but her family disapproved heavily, so they eloped. They eventually accepted my grandfather after some time and reconnected with my grandmother. However, her brother, who got arrested, completely cut her off and didn't speak to her even up until his death. Regardless, my grandparents remained married until my Nana Bai's death in 2017. I love that story and remember it whenever I think of him.
Crowdsourcing a South Asian archive of memories? How beautiful is that? What I love about this is that people are taking ownership of their personal history and creating online communities around their past. Through sharing stories and photographs, we're able to piece together remnants of a shared social and cultural past. These oral histories keep us rooted in a past so many of us still struggle to fully understand. My education and upbringing left huge gaps in my understanding of the ideas, people, and movements that shaped the culture of South Asia. Brown History on Instagram has helped me and so many others piece parts of our histories together. Just a few weeks ago, I saw a post of a full-page feature from a newspaper in 1940 that showed one of the first South Asian weddings in Vancouver. 200 guests were present, half were white. Although it was a Sikh wedding, the article refers to them as Hindus. This may seem like a tiny error about a wedding, but it's actually much bigger than that. In 1940, and still today, the histories of brown people in this country have been shaped and told through the white perspective. The Gwillim sisters' letters point to the same thing.
The Indian army is formed partly of Hindus, partly of Muslims. They have until this time shown great attachment to the English. They submitted quietly to every regulation, fought our battles faithfully. The Hindus think themselves polluted by the touch of leather. The Muslims, it is well known, abominate the hogs.
Mary's observations about the army fall in line with her English roots. While she's a product of her time, these letters are a stark reminder of her ignorance and position in society. Letters like this help us understand the importance of projects like the Brown History Podcast. Some of my favorite photos on the Instagram account are the ones submitted for the Brown History photo album. Old photos of men and women who resemble my grandparents include captions that retell their journeys across oceans by their children and grandchildren, who submit these photos to the account. I was looking through old photos under my bed, and I found two of my grandma that I thought of submitting. The first is a photo of her in the 60s, living in Edmonton. She was brand new on Canadian soil, donning a sari in front of her driveway, heading to school.
I'm just looking this picture at very, very bad time in Edmonton. When I came in 1965 and landed in Edmonton. And after 4 years, I got this new job in the new land for teaching. And I was wearing my sari. At that time, there were just 4 or 5 family in Edmonton. And the people who were here, the student and anybody else, they did not see any brown people, and especially in a sari. So when I went to school teaching them, and they thought that I was wearing in pajama. And that's what I'm remembering. I was at that time 30 years old. It was very new experience for me, because first of all, the language, because in India I was teaching, but there was not English medium. You teach in your own national language, but here I have to teach in the English. So it was new experience, new land, new people, new culture. So it was a little bit challenge, but I try my best to settle in this new environment to make my living. And I try my best, and I did it.
The second photo is really special to me. It's me and my nanny at the Rideau Center in Ottawa with Santa Claus.
Okay, when I came from Edmonton to Ottawa, Ottawa was a very beautiful place and little warmer, and we adjusted very fast. You were born as my first granddaughter. That's Ottawa is always be a very, very important place in our life, because the first grandchild is very important and very fortunate to have that. And now looking this picture at the Christmas time, how we, you know, make you very pretty, put in clothes and go to the Santa Claus. And we have a picture. This picture, I remember, I took you there and I went to the Santa Claus and you were laughing very loud. And I remember this picture of those days, and like I was very young. Now I grew quite a bit because I am in over 80s, and now I see my second generation, they are growing up and we assimilated in Canadian culture. We are just modern Canadian family. We are just everything. We celebrate all the Canadian festival very gay and joyfully, because my all children, everybody, we love that, and that's my home. So I am very proud to say my second generation is growing and settling here, and very different from our generation to there. And I'm very happy to see them. It's all technology and they are growing up, and I see you. So I'm enjoying that.
Platforms like the Brown History Podcast could include stories like this from my nanny. These stories are increasingly occupying the internet, symbolizing the very purpose of their creation. That history, personal and shared, is multidimensional. It's an unspoken but concerted movement to democratize history and share narratives aging on the sidelines. How do we keep shifting what society deems worth sharing and worth remembering? I talked to Sonia Dhaliwal about this. She's a data and digital collections librarian at the University of Toronto, Scarborough.
I would say ultimately what both archivists and librarians are trying to do is to make information accessible and more widely available. How we go about it slightly differs, where archivists are usually focused on more sort of unique types of records, more primary source-based materials, and the organization is a little bit different. Whereas with libraries, it's always about collecting information and widely disseminate it as much as possible. I'd say where the overlap is happening is in a lot of like the digital practices, because it is always changing. There's so much of it. Adopting practices from each sort of profession kind of helps create the most robust back end so that users are then able to access digital collections and use them for whatever research purposes that they have.
You know, as a South Asian, as someone who was born and raised in Canada, you know, I'd love to be able to find places and other resources to learn more about my ancestry. And maybe I don't know where to look, but people like you are doing that kind of work.
My day-to-day work sometimes looks like helping with the metadata of these collections, where we're now thinking through things like, how do you do multilingual metadata when metadata standards themselves are assuming that everything's in English? Naming practices differ in how you name people in Tamil versus how you name them in English. You know, the conventional first, middle, last name doesn't necessarily exist in Tamil. So how do you sort of translate the two when you're creating metadata that's in English and in Tamil? And it's important to recognize the original language of the collections as well, because it's part of the object's history as well. Understanding the role that the archives has actually played in upholding, creating, and maintaining colonial infrastructures is really important here. I think it's important for archival literacy to include a component of like how archives were actually used to facilitate colonial governments, colonial policies. What those records now hold is sort of this legacy of like what was done to people, essentially. There's only sort of one perspective that often exists in colonial archives themselves. And so this effort to sort of decolonize the archive has to sort of examine the archive's position itself. So positionality, I think, is important for people to know when they're going into an archive and when they're examining archival records. I kind of navigated this whole situation of like learning my history within a very Western pedagogical framework.
Do you think your personal experience with your own history helped to shape the approach you take towards your own work?
I also grew up learning a lot about my own family's history or my family's background, very fragmented through a lot of like just stuff that grandparents said here and there. I think my family only ever talk about history like during the era of the British Raj and then after. In my undergrad, I took a class called The History of Modern South Asia, which was taught by a white Canadian man, but very much like somebody who was very aware of, he's a white guy teaching brown history. And there were multiple people in that class who had, were South Asian Canadian, born and raised, like second generation, and were in that class to try and learn something about their culture, about, you know, where their people come from. Because I think, yeah, it was an overwhelmingly positive experience. And I really appreciated how forthright the professor was in identifying his own position of, you know, I'm a white guy teaching brown history to a bunch of people who are here to also learn about their own history. Because the one conversation that really stood out to me was when I came home and I was talking to my mom about one of the lectures that we had on what's called like the Indian Mutiny in 1847, I believe, or I could have my dates wrong. And my mom just kind of looked at me and was like, what are you talking about? What mutiny? I think you mean the First War of Independence. I had to really reflect on like what I was saying and the position that I was being taught this event, essentially, you know, like to say that it's a mutiny, I would say is a very Eurocentric position. Whereas my mom, who had learned about the exact same event from going to school in India, learned it as, you know, the First War of Independence, which really is kind of what it was, right? It was the first time that the people of South Asia rebelled against the East India Company and what it was doing there. I think that was the first time I had to recognize like positionality mattered and who the information and how it was being filtered, how that plays a role in how I'm able to sort of digest and make opinions for myself. Where the oral history, I think, can really make this one-dimensional narrative a lot more dynamic is sort of showing what the day-to-day lived impact was through people's life stories, right? Like people talking about their experiences of like living during the mutiny. Like, what was that like when all of a sudden it's not the East India Company influencing South Asia? Now it's like the British government that's taking over, or something like partition is huge, right? Partition happened not just in along the Pakistan-India border, but also along the Bangladesh-India border, right? But we only really hear about one side, or at least I only really grew up hearing mostly about the India-Pakistan one. Whereas there's like this whole other boundary that also existed, and it's still, the effects are still felt today. Certainly like my own family's oral histories like only really deal with our family and our immediate context in India's history. But I think if there was any way to sort of share more lived experiences, I think it would really help sort of add more layers and more textures to what India or South Asia actually is.
I agree. I often feel a great sense of connection to other South Asian stories on social media, and it helps me rethink my own, or at least contextualize my own in a way that wasn't available to me before.
Because I think like immigrant parents can definitely have this like very nostalgic view of the place that they left behind. And I think even from my own parents, like the way that they talk about the India that existed when they lived there, it does not exist in that way today at all. They present this very idyllic life. But even when they go back, they find it really hard to try and fit in, because the village that my parents grew up in, like one of the villages doesn't even exist anymore because it's been absorbed by the city. The other one is on its way there. My mom's family doesn't even own the house that she grew up in anymore. So it's just not the same. I think their memories are often like frozen in time. So it can be hard for second generation who are going back to places where South Asia itself is like very, it's becoming quite modernized in a way. Like there's so much more global influence there. So it can be hard to sort of try and piece together like what you're hearing from your family versus what you're actually seeing when you're there, because the two don't always connect.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that's something that I am also internally struggling with, because I have this desire to visit so much of North India where my family is from. It looks very different. I don't think my dad's house he grew up in, also, I don't think their family has it anymore. And you know, he went to a boarding school in the Himalayas. I mean, that school still exists, but I'm sure it looks very different from when he was a kid. And you know, because of social media and Instagram and travel influencing and all of this kind of stuff, there's these idealized versions of what India looks like through this, you know, very filtered lens, obviously. And I do wonder, like, if a lot of the sort of the places that are probably also frozen in my dad's memory or even my grandparents, like, what's even left of it, you know? And of the remaining relatives there, like, they probably don't feel as curious, right? Because that's just home for them. Whereas I'm coming in, oh my God, I'm just trying to understand so much of my background. So it's one of those, you know, eventually whenever I make my way to India, it's going to be complicated trip with a lot of feelings, I think, for me. With research like the Gwilym sisters, because they exist in universities, so much of our understanding feels legitimized because, well, this is a collection, it's from a university, of course it has to be the right thing to read or the right thing to share. Is this Eurocentric framing intentional?
I think, yes, it's intentional because that's where it started, right? Like archives were used to maintain colonial governments and hold records that documented all of that. Is it still supposed to be that way? That I kind of struggle with, because I think most archives are trying to not be that, but I don't know if the work goes far enough sometimes. I think there's always a lot of discussion about what can change and what things can be done differently and how to reach out to other communities, but I don't always think people know how to do it. Some of this could come down to the fact that the profession itself is not very diverse. Like there's very few BIPOC archivists or librarians out there. Even if intentions are to decolonize the environment, when the people who are trying to do that don't even understand how to go about it because they don't have the experience, like they have never lived the life of, you know, a South Asian woman or a South Asian Canadian or whomever, then they just don't have an awareness that exists with being somebody who isn't white, essentially, in a white world, right?
What I love about Sonia's work is this idea of ownership. Extending an archive to a contributor to tell their personal story and carving a place for themselves in history is really validating. Thanks to social media, of course, everyday people are able to tell their history from their perspective, and their stories and cultures are no longer bound by gatekeepers. Brick and mortar museums kind of exist as analog platforms controlled by a small group of people, giving them a lot of controls to decide what is on display and to present the exhibits in their own way. Social media, on the other hand, is easier to navigate. Yes, algorithms dictate what you end up seeing on your timeline, but it can be less intimidating to share something because these apps encourage us to share in the first place. Let's take Twitter, for example. Twitter has helped make news gathering easier and more immediate, and entirely transformed how journalists like me report on different communities. We can hear people's firsthand accounts and experiences, often in real time. Imagine if the Gwilym sisters tweeted some of the things they wrote in their letters. In order to amplify more brown voices, we need platforms that can share our stories in raw and unfiltered ways. But that's easier said than done. We need collaboration from editors, journalists, and newsroom leaders from all walks of life. I wanted to talk about this with another journalist and podcaster, so I chatted with Tamara Kandacker. She's the host of the CBC podcast, Nothing is Foreign. As podcast hosts, as journalists that we both are, a lot of people, a lot of old-timey newspaper people say we are writing the first draft of history. I've never been a fan of that expression, but I think in 2021, so much of that idea has shifted in the industry and it's pivoted to audio storytelling. So in a larger context, throughout this podcast, throughout this series, we've been talking about what role librarians and archivists play in documenting history and making it relevant and accessible today. So in your opinion, how do you think these types of industries, so non-media people, what do you think they'll say about how we as journalists are documenting history in this sort of audio podcasting world that we're in now?
It's hard to even answer it and just answer this question in just like an audio specific way, because the first thing that comes to mind for me is I think they'll probably say that a lot of the documenting happened on social media first, that a lot of the historians were just like average people who saw things and tweeted them or took video and like posted it, that the number of sources where you could get your information expanded vastly, probably too much, that many more people just felt like they could contribute to the conversation and to that process of documenting the history. And maybe that a lot of our understanding of what has been happening came from commentary from people that we trust. And that relationship between the person consuming the content and the person delivering the content has become really important. I think that's like a distinguishing feature of the way that we consume the news right now and the way that we document history right now. And I think that extends to audio. Like with podcasting, there's an expectation that the host will build a relationship to the listener. There is an expectation of openness and like vulnerability. And that's what keeps people coming back. They want to feel like they're listening to a friend explain the news to them, which I kind of love because I don't know how to do it any other way. And I don't think that I would have made a great traditional broadcaster. So yeah, I don't know. I think there is much more of a willingness or even an appetite to have the news presented to you in an informal and chatty way that's less crafted. And audio storytelling in the form of podcasting, obviously the other huge change is the makeup of who is delivering the news. We're not anywhere near where we should be in terms of diversity in newsrooms in North America, but there have definitely been improvements. And I think we're moving in the direction of a more accurately representative, more inclusive media.
Yeah, to your point on that, two things. First of all, I do agree. I think we are sort of breaking a wall in terms of who are sources and who are people who are integral to the story. And a lot of those people are everyday people. We just can message on social media to, you know, add context, add color. And I think that's really helps bring people in that more friendly, everyday kind of tone, like you're saying. But do you think, I do agree that, you know, we're getting there in terms of diversity and inclusion. But as a woman of color, do you think there's more of a burden placed on you to make sure you're bringing in new or marginalized voices in your coverage? And quite frankly, do you think that's an unfair responsibility for you to have?
I think there is a burden for sure, or at least I put that pressure on myself a lot, and I feel really responsible and I feel disappointed when I fail to do that because I feel like I'm letting people down if I have this platform and I'm not pushing to bring new voices to the table. I don't know if I'd call it an unfair burden. I think it's something I want to do just because it makes for stronger journalism in a country that's so diverse and where there's, you know, people from so many different interesting backgrounds. But I do wish that my non-POC colleagues, my white colleagues, were better at doing that and tried harder to do that. Absolutely.
Do you ever feel like you've been tokenized in a newsroom, or have you ever felt the need to address it if you have felt sort of othered in a meeting or just in the way maybe you've been treated by leadership?
I have. I've had my face, I'm brown, I've had my face used to promote things in a way that's made me pretty uncomfortable, in a way that's like pretty transparent, and that, you know, they're trying to showcase the diversity of their newsroom. And I've brought it up very gently, just sort of pointing out that maybe the language about diversity in this ad is a little too on the nose. Maybe my face kind of speaks for itself and we don't need to go further than that to point this out. It's the stuff like that. And it is something that you always wonder about, like, why am I being asked to cover the story, or why am I being asked to help on a certain assignment? And then you wonder, do I shy away from this or do I lean into it? Especially when you're asked to report on communities of color. I know that I'm more of an expert on some of these things just by virtue of my own life experience. So maybe it's a good thing. But in short, yeah, I think that's a very common experience for most people of color who work in journalism.
So where's the line between being from the group you're reporting or collecting from and being burdened to do so because of a lack of understanding from white colleagues? Oftentimes, I think the work POCs create, and this can be extended to the archives we also create, it gets toned down because of the people above us or the people interacting with them. I don't know, this is something I've discussed with a lot of friends over the years, but I do think there's an unspoken mindset that reporters and editors have to tone down their coverage to appeal to a white audience. Obviously, that's, I think, something people are critical of when it comes to legacy media, especially, you know, not everyone agrees with me. And they do think that, of course, we live in a media industry now where there is so much more niche content. There are news outlets that are produced, written by, created by people of color, by the South Asian diaspora specifically. So, of course, there's lots of waves that are like improving in that sense. But do you think this idea that we have to tone down for a wider audience, do you think there is any truth to that?
Yes, for sure. I think that's why we're still having this nonsense objectivity debate in Canadian media, right? Like, I know for a fact that something is racist, but there's still a question around whether I can call it that because some people would disagree. And then my objectivity as a reporter would be questioned. When I'm interviewing people of color, I often have the urge to have a really frank conversation with them about race and ask them really honest questions that come from my perspective as someone who sees how racism factors into so many of the stories that I cover. But like, I'll tone it down because I know in the back of my head, I know it won't be seen as objective, or some people will dismiss it as not objective. And yeah, I've also had experiences where I'll pitch a story with a racial angle and my editor won't even know what to do with that information, or they just won't get it. And then I'll be like, okay, I guess like this is not for a mainstream audience. So I'll drop that idea and it just won't happen. But yeah, I don't think that we've reached the level of discourse on race in Canada that I'd hope we'd be at.
It wasn't until I was out of university that I realized how much I wanted to and needed to search for my community's stories. Stories that weren't being heard or shared. And moreover, stories that were in danger of being lost. I discovered a social media account called Seek Archive. They do similar work to the Brown History account, but with a twist. Their website tells me they're developing a Google Calendar app that can be used to notify their members of significant events that happened on this day via push notifications. And this got me thinking. Nobody, including me, is claiming to be an expert in South Asian history or culture. We are as much consumers of this content as we are producers. What does our reliance on memory say about the very nature of oral history? Of course, facts and archival research support so many of these digital archive projects, but there are some things that remain true simply because of the way in which people remember them. That needs to be celebrated and normalized. Lots of these social media-based projects I've mentioned are what I'd like to call memory projects. They can't replace the work of a historian or other official ways of record keeping, but these photos and posts can't be subjected to scholarly analysis either. These social media-driven archives help generate an appetite for history beyond scholarly circles, and that's also something worth celebrating. Oral storytelling, whether for digital archives or journalism, is a legitimate and time-old way of sharing our history and shaping our history. Throughout this series, I've been asking myself, what role does memory play in the reconstruction of the past? It's clear that our collective memory can become a repository of an alternative account, a version of history that comes closer to the truth. And that's exactly what we should be striving for. Thanks for listening to Lost Voices, an untold story of the South Asian diaspora, a podcast by McGill University, hosted and written by me, Alicia, and produced in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Anna, Richard, Steph, Lauren, Sonia, Tamara, Sophie, Maria, Kanika, and others, like my grandma. In our next and final episode, we'll be looking at the archive from a bird's eye view to think about how new spaces can spawn new archival opportunities.